Dr. Nick and Hot Aussie Chick Show is brought to you by the LasVegasAdvisor.com, CasinoMeister.com, and ThePog.com. Three great sites for all your casino gaming information needs.
If you're receiving this transmission, then this operation is a success. Dr. Nick and the Hot Aussie Chick are in the house and ready to dissect blackjack, poker, and everything in between.
Good afternoon, good evening. Wherever you are, whatever time it is, you are listening to Dr. Nick and the Hot Aussie Chick. Now, unfortunately, the Hot Aussie Chick is having technical difficulties, and she will not be with us today. But in her place is a friend of mine and a very good friend of Danielle's that she's known for several years, Eric O'Day. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Not doing too bad. For those who don't know, Eric has a pretty full resume. He is an actor, a poker player, former wrongfully incarcerated person, and who has been had his story chronicled in a couple different mediums, and the most recent movie that just came out called 3 Years in Pakistan. Is that correct, Aaron? Is that the name of it?
It's called 3 Years in Pakistan, the Eric O'Day story.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, I have not seen the movie yet, but I have seen the semi-documentary chronicled in the National Geographic special 3 Years Abroad. Locked Up Abroad. I'm sorry, it's just... I'm getting the titles confused, but it was a very interesting story. And why don't you just give us the rundown of the Reader's Digest version of what happened there, Eric?
Well, what you're trying to say is I did the documentary Locked Up Abroad, which is called Banged Up Abroad Overseas. I did that just 7 years ago for season 6. And in that story, they crammed a 13-hour interview into 48 minutes, and they only took the meat of the story out and just told the exciting stuff. Problem with that is they only told 14 months of my incarceration, where I was incarcerated 3 years, and they left a lot out. They left a lot of unanswered questions, and the reason that my documentary that's coming out on October 2nd on iTunes and all VOD platforms is called 3 Years in Pakistan, the Eric O'Day story. It tells the entire 3 years. It answers a lot of unanswered questions, and it explains more about me than Locked Up Abroad ever did. So it'll hopefully give people a better sense of who I am, why I was lured into making these trips, My goal in sharing this documentary is basically for those out there who think that just because you go to jail, oh, you must be guilty. What happened to me was I was tricked by a very good friend of mine to unknowingly smuggle narcotics for him back into the U.S. And I did it under the guise of I thought I was being used to smuggle to import expensive leather samples from different countries to beat the import tax, and what we were really being used to do was smuggle narcotics unknowingly. When you watch the documentary, you're going to learn that this happens a lot. Drug smugglers are shameless, and they will get their product across any way they can, especially by having anyone do it for them, by keeping them in the dark, because they figure by keeping them in the dark that they won't draw suspicion to themselves. Also, they won't have to pay them what they're really worth, and it happens all the time. And that's what, if I had seen a documentary like this back in the day when I was a kid, I really believe I would have been more wise, more spry, to know that it was just too good to be true, and I wouldn't have let this happen to me. So by telling my story, the ultimate goal is to prevent this from happening to someone else, even if it is at my own expense.
Exactly. So it serves as a cautionary tale for players or for people who want, if the situation sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Now, people on this show know very well that being arrested and locked up is not necessarily mean you're guilty. I myself was arrested last year, and I spent 7 days in the Clark County detention system, and ultimately was exonerated because what they thought I did was just wrong. They thought I was using a cheating device at a casino game, which really didn't make any sense for me because I lost almost $2,000 that particular night. But in any event, we all are well aware of the presumption of innocence, and unfortunately in countries like Pakistan, you really don't have any recourse, correct?
No, you don't. Yeah. Especially in Pakistan, you don't. If what they do in Pakistan is people, they have a thing called physical remand in Pakistan. Physical remand is exactly what it sounds like. They figure if they can't get the truth out of you, they can beat it out of you. Right. So a lot of people will get tortured in Pakistan and what the people who are torturing them are doing are asking for names and other people who are guilty, and these people, to get them to stop beating them, will simply spout out any name that they can think of, and they'll start giving up their neighbors, their friends, the person who they were in the taxi with that day, and then the Pakistani authorities will go and start arresting everyone whose names were given up, beat them, and then they'll start giving up names. So right. For a crime that's been committed, potentially dozens and dozens of innocent people can be arrested, and they'll even confess to these crimes simply to have the torture stop. It's a joke. Their legal system is a joke. The way that they interrogate people is a joke, and all they're doing is beating people to giving false statements about themselves, their friends, their family, and strangers to simply stop the pain. It's an absolute joke. And
now, from what I remember and recall in the National Geographic episode, is despite the beating, you never did give up. You remained faithful and you stuck to your convictions, and you never did say I did it.
Correct. No, on the third day, they just wanted me to admit the drugs are mine, and I never admitted anything. I kept my mouth shut. I stuck to my innocence, and I was able to leave being tortured for 3 days with my head held high.
Good, excellent. Now, we're going to step back a little bit. You were an actor of some notoriety. You were in quite a few different movies. And the first one you cut your teeth on, I guess your first big role, was Dude, Where's My Car? Which, by the way, was a great film, and I love it.
Oh, thank you. I got lucky on that job. I filmed that job over the course of a couple months, and even though my role didn't seem that big, I got to work alongside Ashton Kutcher and Sean William Scott for several months, and
right.
it was fun being one of the team there and meeting and hanging out with everyone, with Jennifer Gardner and with several other notables that went on to do great things. It was
right.
The movie's almost 20 years old, and
right.
Now, at the time, that was the big movie that I was on.
Let me ask you: Did people on that film set think it would be that big, or was there an inkling, or was it just like, oh, it's one of these B films, so to speak?
I mean, no one was. It was like any other set. No one's walking around set going, "Oh, this is going to be so huge. This is going to be so big." And they're just going about doing their day to days and filming what needs to be done. And everyone on set was pretty cool. I would bring a football on set, and I would throw the football around with the leads and different actors during takes. And it was like summer camp when we were filming it, but it was. Everyone was very friendly. No one was walking around thinking it was going to be as big a hit as it was.
These were stars, big stars, A-listers, before they were A-listers. So it was like right at the beginning of the career, and you were there. So it was seems to be like a good way to get some notoriety and move on to other parts. I think your recent picture or your recent film, you're in a couple episodes of The Mayans that are coming out.
Yeah, I'm working on the show. I worked on the show Mayan the whole season. I did all the motorcycle riding for a few of the leads. And I also got to play a character in two of the episodes that when they go to the casinos, I play one of the security guards who is working at the casino. And the creator of the show, Elgin James, says that I will absolutely be brought back next season and for the foreseeable future whenever they're at the casinos.
Outstanding.
It's great just to do all the motorcycle riding on the show.
Yeah,
I've
seen it. It's pretty good. It's a derivative show of the Sons of Anarchy, which was a rival gang, the Mayans. So it's actually pretty good. Sidestepping, one of the great motorcycle riders was Steve McQueen. He was an excellent. I think he did all the motorcycle riding in either The Great Escape, was that, or one of the other films. I forget he was in, but he did a lot of the stunt ridings for both the Nazis and thing. And he was just probably the coolest cat of all time.
Oh, probably. I mean, I remember The Great Escape, and I remember all the motorcycle riding in that movie. I mean, I don't know if he did the jump over the barbed wire fence, but if he did, that's awesome.
Yeah. Now, you said that you're doing the riding for the leads, and you're also a stuntman. Is that where that came in from, too, or...?
Well, that's why I'm doing the riding for the leads,
right.
Because I am a stuntman.
Right, right. Now, despite that, does it take a toll on your body, or do you kind of get used to it? There's certain things that you learn...
I've been a stuntman now, stuntman for 26 years. I've been an actor stuntman. I've been in the entertainment industry, mostly doing physical acting roles. But as a motorcycle rider, honestly, it's easy for me because I ride anyways.
Right.
When I was given the job, I wasn't the first one who was given the job. Chuck Norris's kid, Eric Norris, is the one who was coordinating the show when I finally got hired. And his exact words to me were, "Don't bullshit me. Can you ride?"
Oh.
And the reason he was asking this was because the other stunt guys kept dropping the bikes, and these are huge 1600 engine Harley Davidsons. And when I told him, "Yeah, I can ride," he said to me, "Okay, where did you train?" I said, 405-101, which are the freeways out here in LA.
Right.
I ride full time. He goes, "All right, we're going to give you a shot." And I got out there to do the reshoots and the pilot, and never looked back. I stayed on for the whole season, and
awesome.
they ended up calling me the utility stuntman because I started filling in for literally everywhere. I started doubling several of the leads on the motorcycles. I started playing nondescript stunt roles or action characters, and then I got the audition for a role, and I booked it. And when everyone saw me on set in episode 3, they were all like, "Hey, hey!" They were all
excited awesome.
That it was me because they already knew me from set from doing all the stunts.
Now, I remember when we met here at the World Series of Poker. I think you told us a story where your motorcycle nearly blew up on the way into from LA, and you had to have it towed back.
When I was coming back from the World Series a couple years back, my motorcycle caught on fire. It was hot. A piston broke out of my motorcycle and it started caught on fire. I pulled over and it was a nightmare. It sucked.
Well, whatever doesn't kill you only makes you stronger, as our good philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche says.
Going back to
Pakistan for a moment, Danielle wrote the article called "Death Row Poker Pro," and you did play poker in prison in Pakistan. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why, how it kept your mind straight and how it helped you get by there?
I was introduced to the game of Texas Hold'em poker. The very first time I ever played poker was on death row. I was put on death row for the first 9.5 months in prison because the superintendent that was there at the time figured it was where I was going to end up anyways, and also it was probably the safest place for me because everyone in prison kept trying to kill me. And finally, a new superintendent came in and took me off of death row, and I could never be in general population. I was put in a 2-cell, which was a private cell block. But before they did that, I learned how to play poker from a friend of mine, a guy named Murad. And we would play poker. We would play for, like, usually it was like 5 or 10 rupees to buy in. $1 was roughly 60 rupees, so 5 or 10 rupees is not that much money. But in Pakistan, you know, it's a lot of money. And we would use the money to buy either yogurt or chicken or other food. So players were playing literally to eat. And we, even though some of the players were very well off, they weren't hurting as bad. They were just playing to kill time. I was one of the players who was playing at the beginning for food because I was hungry. But I was also playing to kill time, and I was learning how to play this game in a different language. And so I was Danielle and the Australians who nicknamed me the Death Row player. And it sort of stuck. So in the poker world, my nickname is Death Row.
Well, there you go, and that's a heck of a way to introduce. So you're literally, in some respects, playing for your survival, and so that's
a lot of players were. Yes.
Now, let me ask you, does that put an added pressure on you when they're playing, or is it just kind of, you just instinct take over, or is it something that if you're in a tournament and you're playing, it kind of helped you train as the psychological component, so you're not, okay, it's just a game, literally, but...
In prison, it's hit a lot of pressure on a lot of people because a lot of guys were, you know, playing with their last 5 rupees and 10 rupees, and they were playing very, you know, very seriously. Whereas you had guys who just were killing time and weren't very good.
Yes.
But you have some players who are a little bit desperate. In jail, people are very desperate, and they need to. They don't have the outside resources. They don't have family members sending them money. So any means of eating is crucial to them. So I played with a lot of desperate players in jail in Pakistan.
Right. Now, from my time being incarcerated for just under about a week is when I was, and I was literally almost ready to bounce off the wall in that time, and that was in an American jail in Las Vegas. How did you handle the mental component of that? I mean, were you just, what were you doing to occupy your time? How did that come into play?
Don't hate me, but you cut out there. Can you ask me that question
I said,
again?
In my time in jail, which was just under a week, I was about ready to bounce off the walls. I was going crazy. So how did you approach the mental toughness that you needed to, quote-unquote, survive for the 3 years that you were there?
The mental toughness was, it was mostly anger. It was a couple different things, and it changed from time to time. Their anger for the man that set me up is what absolutely got me through some of the toughest days. Like when I was just depressed and down on my luck, I just thought about getting my hands around that motherfucker's neck who set me up one day, and that helps. I mean,
right.
Anger is a good damn thing. Well, as time went by, a girl that I had been in love with since I was in kindergarten, you know, the girl that I had, she started writing to me in jail in Pakistan, and my goal shifted to trying to get back to her. And then when a lot more time went by, and it was too much for her to handle waiting there for, you know, years and years, and she ended up she almost made it. She waited almost 3 years for me, but she ended up meeting someone 4 months shy of me getting out. And she couldn't handle it, so I had to shift back my focus to anger, and just by that time I had already adjusted to the situation. But it was usually, you have to find hope no matter where you're at. And on the hardest days, the very hardest days, like when I had crazy earaches and I was in so much pain, and the only times I ever thought about killing myself was when my ears were hurting so bad, and I thought to myself, hey, it wouldn't be suicide if I kill myself, it would be humane because I'm in so much fucking pain from these ears that are gnawing at my head. I had to set my goals really low. I had to tell myself, just wait 5 more minutes, just hang in there, 5 more minutes, and I would set my goal for 5 more minutes, and then 5 minutes would come and go, and then I'd set my goal for just another 5 minutes, and before I knew it, I got through the day, and before I knew it, I got through the week, and then when my ears would start to heal again, I got through the month. And if you don't set your goals for out of your reach, because if you do, it's going to seem so far that you're not going to be able to get to there, so you make your goals very small. And in prison, you just get through the day. Your goal is to survive and get through the day sometimes.
Now, you said that you were not in general population. Was that mostly because of your complexion and you were American?
Absolutely. Because I went to jail right after 9/11.
Right.
So there was a lot of anti-West sentiment going on. I went to jail before they even started bombing Afghanistan.
Okay.
And I was there before, during, and after the Iraqi war. So that whenever the West did anything to Muslim brothers and sisters, I was the one that they would look at. And they can't get to Bush or any other Americans, but they could get to me. Someone put a 5,000 rupee bounty on my head in prison, and roughly at the time that was $87, and people tried to get it. I got hit with a rake, I got stabbed, I got in more fights than I can count. And it was literally, I had to always be ready for some dipshit trying to either make a name for themselves or collect a 5,000 rupee bounty, which is a lot of damn money in Pakistan.
And you are you're a pretty fit guy, so they knew what they were getting into, so thankfully you were able to fend them off. One thing that I noticed in the National Geographic special, and I wanted to ask you how true to life this was, but at the end of your incarceration, when you were getting out, it seemed that the prisoners were all celebrating you. Did that actually happen?
Not like that, but by the time that this is why my new documentary that's coming out 3 years in Pakistan is really good to watch, because it'll answer all those questions. Locked Up Abroad only told the first 14 months of my story. So the first year, roughly, was the worst year I had in jail by far, because people hated me. People didn't understand me. All they knew was I was, you know, an American, and I was getting better treatment than other people because I had my own cell, and they wanted, and there was a lot of jealousy, but then also there was a lot of animosity towards the West. Now, after that first year and 2 months, what Locked Up Abroad does is tell up to the point where I had all my fingers broken, my shoulder caved in, and by the guards, because they were stealing money from me, and I refused to give them any more money, and I got in a fight with Gold Leaf and the other guards. Mm-hmm. Well, after Gold Leaf got fired and the other guards got fired, everyone in the prison benefited off that, because Gold Leaf wasn't just making my life hell. He was making everyone's life in that prison hell, by far. Mm-hmm. And everyone in that prison benefited off Gold Leaf not being there anymore. And when they all knew that I was the reason that Gold Leaf was no longer there to steal from them, to beat from them, to extort from them, they started appreciating my being there. Like, hey, you know what? That was pretty cool what you did. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And also learning the language was very crucial to me, like, so that people could communicate with me, so they could understand me, so they could start to see me as a human being. And by this time, I was having conversations with people. I was having conversations with guards. The guards started to see me as a human being, and I started to see them as human beings. And now people they liked my jokes. They liked my sense of humor. They liked my charm, and they liked me as a person. And I would tell all the guards, hey, no one in my cell block is going to get beat anymore for money. If you guys want money, go get us some food. I'll pay you. Here, I want VCD players. You're going to make a lot of money, but you're going to make it by bringing us in things that'll help our time pass. You're not going to beat it out of us anymore. And the guards were happy. They were happy because they would beat people for like 20 rupees, whereas here I am paying them 1,000 rupees to go get me a damn CD player. They're making way the hell more money, and it's easier, and people aren't hating them anymore. And it helped change everyone's perception of me. And by the time I left that prison, the people that I had fought when I came in were praying for me to go home, because I had become friends with these people. They didn't see me as a terrible Westerner anymore. They saw me as the guy who brought in a water well, the guy who fixed up the whole cell block, the guy who made a great garden, the guy who, you know, organized games and poker tournaments and hosted dinner parties and lunch parties, and who took care of the place. I figured if I was going to live there, I might as well make it as nice as possible. And I had a pretty good life in prison for the last 2 years that I was there. Locked Up Abroad didn't touch on any of that. And at least in my documentary, people can now understand, oh, that makes more sense.
But it still was a relief, though, I'm sure, to go home. Even no matter how comfortable it gets, you know, it's still going. Nothing beats going home.
No, absolutely. I was happy to finally leave. But, I mean, I sometimes miss jail. I miss jail because I had made some, great friends in there. I had some lasting relationships in there, and I learned to play poker with my best friend Murad in jail. And if it wasn't for him, I don't believe I would be playing poker today and making a living playing poker today because of him. Because of what I learned in prison, I can survive anywhere in the world now.
Yeah, that's exactly true. Shifting gears a little bit. Oh, just one last thing. You were released around Christmas time, correct?
I was released December 23rd, 2004, two days before Christmas.
And you made it home on the 26th, right?
Well, I made it back into America at Chicago O'Hare Airport on Christmas Day, but I missed my connecting flight because I was the only white guy getting off the plane, and I got strip searched at the airport.
No good deed goes unpunished, it looks like.
No, they're like, there's something wrong. This guy's been gone too long. He's the only white guy coming back.
Well, I'm sure the State Department didn't escort you out or give you papers of some sort.
When you're a foreigner in Pakistan and you get released from prison, you have to have your country come and get you out of jail. And the American Embassy did get me out of jail, and they brought me to the airport and sent me home, but they didn't fly home with me.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay, so that's the Death Row Poker Pro, that part of it. Now let's switch gears a little bit. And recently, earlier this year, a movie by the name of Molly's Game came out. And do you feel comfortable talking a little bit about that?
Sure.
We'll just do broad strokes here. Because we don't want to get anybody in trouble here. But a lot of that stuff in Molly's Game, I'm not too... Some people I hear it was accurate, and while others say it was not accurate. Now, as a person who actually ran the games, what was your interpretation of that film?
I didn't stay with them from head to toe, and I only helped run games when I could bring players, and so right. I wasn't there from beginning to end and in any way. But Hollywood always doctors things up regardless, or they right. always take the nuts out, or they make things easier and scrambled. So whenever you watch anything, it's just you got
glamorized.
As long as the story is the story, and I think the story mostly is the story, but I know for a fact that she was taken. The people she was running the game with, because they're trying to put it all on her. It wasn't all on her. She was running the game with other people. Okay. And there was an absolute rape going on from the very beginning. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, there's no one running a game like that and only getting tipped to keep the game going. I would never go into a court of law and be like, hey, no, because I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble, right. but I understand from their perspective, they're like, we only took tips in because the house can't take a rape. They took a rake from day one.
It seemed to me kind of pointless because who's paying for the suites and the dealers and the.
But that's Hollywood, and they're also covering their own ass. And I understand. I don't fault them at all. They can't say, "Well, we took a rake from," because she went to court right. for all that, and the judge is like, "Look, it's." The judge probably played poker somewhere too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, this is ridiculous.
Well, I was. I was on the MIT blackjack teams for that movie that 21 came out with Kevin Spacey in the 2000s, mid 2000s, 2008, 2009 around there. A lot of that was greatly doctored. I mean, there's a great line by John Chang who was the original manager who the Kevin Spacey character was based off of. He says, "Well, the book took about half of the book got it about half right." And then the movie threw out that half because it's just everything. It has to be glamorized and glitzed up to sell. And, you know, the Molly's Game, I think it did. Oh, I think Aaron Sorkin, was that his first directorial debut?
I'd have to look it up. I don't know. But was the character playing you? Was it Jim Sturgess?
The characters there were kind of a composite of players. And you got to remember on the MIT blackjack teams, yeah, there was many as 65, 70 people going on trips. There wasn't just four people.
And they lowered it. The Hollywood likes to do that.
Yeah, and they're condensing it. Together. And how it was broken up was one of the guy's girlfriends got pissed because he broke up with her and then took the MIT yearbooks. And went to the Griffin Detective Agencies, and they blew the whistle on them. Now, one thing that you have to realize, it said they made millions and millions of dollars. I think the first MIT team, the team that was based off us only made about $180,000 over 18 months. Now, when you split that, half of it goes into investors.
That's $10,000 a week only.
Yeah. Now, what I'm saying is if you split that up between players, half of it goes to investors, which is $90,000. The other half would go to players. That's $90,000.
So $5,000.
And if you got 60 players, it doesn't really go very far.
So, no, not at all.
Yeah. So it was more of a cool factor type of a thing. And in the movie, they made it sound like the only time they screwed up is when they became reckless. But as you know, in poker, as in blackjack or any gaming that you can play with an advantage at, you could do everything right, but sometimes the cards just don't fall your way. How many times do pocket aces get cracked? It's just you 3 out of 4 times you're gonna win the hand, but there's always that one time, then. that things could go wrong. So again,
that's poker.
Yeah, that's
poker.
That is the best line
for the rest of your life and still lose.
Yeah, that's the best line. That's poker. When something goes wrong, that's poker, and that's what happens.
If you get mad at getting unlucky, then you shouldn't play the game because
it's such a stupid game
to play bad against you.
Yeah, it's such a stupid game. You know, especially when you get bad beat. Like it's just such a stupid game. You know, but when you run hot and you run good, I mean things are. I mean it's like printing money, you know. And
I have no problem getting the calls I want. It's just all I ever hope is that my hands will hold up. I don't play to suck at it. I don't play to get lucky. I play to just get it in good against players. And when my hands hold up, I'm unbeatable.
That's right, and that's how it goes. Now I'm actually going to in November. There's a big Australian Asian Poker Tour event in Australia that we're planning on going to, which is not bad. It's like $100,000 guarantee. And
are you playing at the Crown in Melbourne?
No, it's going to be at it's going to be in Sydney at the Star Casino, I believe. And it's like it's not bad. It's like $200, $200 American, and there's $100,000 guarantee. So it's $80,000 US. So I mean, it's you know, what the hell? You might give it a shot, and if you get lucky, you get lucky, and you win.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Hopefully, most of the people are just there to have fun, and you can just weed your way through them.
Yeah, that's what we're trying. Well, you know, I played in the World Series online event, the online bracelet, and I finished like 196th. Out of like 1,200 people.
What year?
This year. Just as the first year. Event 63, I believe it was.
That's the one that Nippon Java won the year before, right?
I don't think so, because this was the first. This was a bracelet event. And it was the first online bracelet event. But I was like 196 players left. And it was kind of BS, because every other event they were paying top 10%, so it should have been paying 210, and I should have cashed, but they were they played 180, the top 180, and I had like 68,000, and the guy it was blind versus blind. I had 68,000. I was a big blind. He had like 248,000. He raised I think the blinds were like 1,000, 2,000 at this point. He raised to 6,000, and I shoved with pocket kings. And I think he had ace king, and he just caught an ace. So
that's nothing you can do there.
That's poker, right? But
I had a set of kings to a set of aces to Dan Smith at the with 10 of us left in the 5K back in 2012. I mean, and the only thing that could have beat me was a set of aces. There was no flush, no straight draw. Right. Just shitty, man. And I almost folded. Almost fucking folded because he was just doing such a bad acting job.
Right.
I knew he had a great hand. But I had an amazing hand, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's only one hand to beat you in that scenario. There's only one hand to beat you. But, hey, it is what it is. The ups and downs of gaming. But in comparison to what you went through, I think it's just a drop in the bucket.
Nothing. Oh, when that happened to me, someone even asked me, "Oh my God, is that the worst thing that ever happened to you?" I go, "Not even close." First thing I said is, "It can always be worse."
And it seems more often than not, it is with you. I was telling. I think
with
I told
anyone,
you.
I think with anyone, I mean, there's. No matter how bad it gets, it could always be worse.
Yes.
It really could. And I have my arms and my legs. I can still walk. I can still see. I can still hear. Exactly. I'm not, you know, being chained in someone's basement right now, in some bus driver's basement in Columbus, Ohio. You know, like those
exactly.
Girls were for 10-plus years. That would suck.
Yes. And there, you know, I think I mentioned this before we started. You are as close to the biblical character Job as I ever want. Everybody I've ever met who is... the person that is constantly tested by God through bad things that happen to him to maintain his faith, and he certainly does. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with Eric Audet. He's got a new documentary coming out. What are the dates again, Eric?
Well, if you're in town in L.A., we have a week-long release at the Lemley in North Hollywood, which is on Chandler, Lancashire. It's going to be at the Lemley. It's called 3 Years in Pakistan, the Eric Audet Story. But if you can't come to town, you can pre-order it now on iTunes. It'll be available October 2nd on iTunes and all other video on demand platforms, pretty much. It's a documentary that will make you feel better about your own everyday lives. You can laugh at my expense. You can say that my story's bullshit, but bottom line, I want you to be armed with this information. So if something, if someone in your family or friends or that someone you come across is doing something that sounds like what I was lured to do, you can at least tell them, hey, this sounds a lot like what happened to that asshole who got locked up in Pakistan for 3 years. Don't let that happen to you.
Okay. Eric Audet, 3 years in Pakistan, the Eric Audet story. Get it on the platforms. The YouTube truncated story is available online on YouTube. But if you want the full story, order the documentary, The Eric Audet Story, 3 years in Pakistan. Eric, thanks for spending some time with us, and good luck with the release and the shows.
I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem. Bye-bye.